Get ready to expand your horizons and discover great reads. This is Bookbound, a library podcast. Welcome back to Bookbound. I'm Jessica Trotter, and I'm joined at the mic by Marisela Garza and Cheryl Lindemann, and we have another guest today, too.
Yes, we do. One of the joys of library work is getting to work with so many wonderful people. And our guest today is somebody that Mari and I both had the pleasure of working with. She's Christine Martin-Rosatko, and she's a library assistant at the Mason Branch. And she's worked at Cattle, I believe, for 15 years. Yes, started out as a page at the Holt Branch and then transferred to Mason as a library assistant. And welcome, Christine. We're so glad to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and you have a special love of RPG.
Yep, tabletop role-playing games. I actually, under your supervision in Mason, I started a tabletop role-playing group. We are over 10 years now with the group. We started out with mostly teenagers, did some special events for tween ages, and now our group is all ages, so everybody is welcome. We meet on the fourth Friday of the month after the library closes. So you can come in about 6:15 and join and have fun. When we play a lot of different games. The thing I always like to tell people is role-playing games are not just Dungeons and Dragons. That's people immediately go to Dungeons and Dragons. And I'm like, you do realize that there are more stories than Tolkien-esque fantasy. And so I brought a couple other options for people. We have a lot, all of these are in the library system, so you can check them out. One I brought is called Nations and Canons. This uses the 5th edition Dungeons and Dragons rule set, but it is completely based on the Revolutionary War. I actually was lucky enough to meet the creator at Gen Con when I did their pre-Gen Con day, where they have like the educators and
it's librarians and educators
and that kind of thing, and they had people from different companies come in and talk, and I got a chance to talk with him about this, and it's a passion project for him. He is a very big history buff. He actually teaches history too, and he wanted to bring the Revolutionary War to life, so he went through and took the D&D system because it was easier, people know it, but completely reskinned it. So everything is completely based on archetypes that you would find in that era. One of the things I also love that he did is he acknowledges bad things that happened during the Revolutionary War to Native peoples and enslaved peoples and said, we're gonna talk about it, but you don't get to do that. And he's very upfront at the beginning, and he had a sensitivity reader go through every piece of paperwork that has come through this at this point, which now they have like 6 gazetteers about different cities and things like that. And they just had a new campaign come out from Kickstarter. So he's done beautiful work on this. So if you want something that's not magic but has history involved, Nations and Canons is a great one. The other one I brought is near and dear to my heart. I grew up in southwestern Ohio, kind of smack center of what is now a UNESCO World Heritage Site for the Hopewell Monument Builders. So like mounds, Monsanto Mound, that kind of thing. They have acknowledged that as a World Heritage Site. Well, I discovered Coyote and Crow, which is a role-playing game completely every inch of this book is created by Native peoples. They did all the writing, the editing, the art, put together all the publishing stuff. They've done everything possible to be very eco-friendly too. And the whole premise of the game is, what if about the time European expansion was going to start happening, coming over to the Americas, couldn't happen because an asteroid struck the Earth and created an ice age. So now different places in the world have to come together to work, or they're not going to survive this long winter. So colonization could never happen. So this is their idea of several hundred years later, the ice is receding, they can have a lot more travel, it's safer. How has their technology advanced based on their cultures? They created their own language out of multiple cultures that would have been grouped together. The capital city that they use in this is Cahokia, which is an actual native site in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And you can actually go. I haven't gone yet. I really want to go. But there's a little bit of magic, if you want to call it that. The asteroid brought foreign material with it, and it can give people abilities. And you're assumed to be one of those lucky people that gets one of the abilities. Basically, it's like part of your adult ceremony is getting a injection of this material, and then it doesn't hurt you if you don't get anything, but it does cause abilities to manifest. But I love the way they've conceived of their future without European influence, with travel. They have large scale people movers to move between long distances, but once you get off that, you walk, because that's what they've always done. There are people that are designated as hunters. They're the ones that go out and take care of the herds and hunt responsibly so that the herds stay at a good size. But then there are people that are designated artists, so they're brought the food from the hunt. So a lot of the cultural stuff is in there. And they have some really great suggestions that if you are a native player, how you can add your own native heritage to it. So it brings a lot of understanding to non-native peoples, but it also allows natives to engage with a future that might have happened for them. And I love every inch of this book. I have every expansion they've put out at this point. So that's also available. So you can request those through the app or through your local branch and have it sent to you.
And I'd like to reiterate what you told me. It's entirely Indigenous.
Entirely Indigenous creation. Created. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
No, those are always, it's always interesting how people kind of do react. And I mean, I grew up doing D&D, but also doing Clue style games or games based on, I think we did a Jurassic Park game right before the first movie came out.
Oh, fun.
It's much more than just.
Mm-hmm. We have a lot of other things too. We have several IP game systems. So, you know, if you're an Expanse fan, guess what? There's a game.
Right. Right.
So there's a lot more like that. And I frequently am doing what I call gamer advisory. Mm-hmm. So people will come in and go, I'm thinking about this, but where should I start?
Mm-hmm.
Guess what? I can give you an answer.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
Cool.
Okay. We jumped right in. I'm going to jump in. And so we also have some books that we have in common.
Mm-hmm.
And when we talked about you coming in, I kind of pitched this by saying, but also I'm going to talk about Jim Hines. So we went to a signing for Kite Master in the spring.
Mm-hmm. Both of us ended up there. We looked over and we're like, hi.
Yeah, yep. No, I knew a lot of people there. So Jim C. Hines is a local author. He has lots of stuff out. I've loved his work for years. But this year, he had two books come out, Kite Master in the Spring, which is more true fantasy.
Yeah.
And then, but when we went to this reading, he read from the book that is coming out later this month. And I must confess, I already had the arc for that book at the time, and
you
I was
lucky
just
duck.
Sorry.
Okay, so I know to call you and come. Can I grab that from you when you're done?
Well, that's the thing. If you'll do digital, I can show you how to get them.
Okay,
but that's an aside. But I had gotten a hold of it. It had caught my eye. A, because it's Jim. B, because of the cover of the book, which is. And the cover quote, which basically says Buffy the Vampire Slayer meets Golden Girls.
Mm-hmm.
Think 90s. Well, okay. So the 90s and the early aughts are sort of, the reboots are running rampant. This is just when I started my career, which tells you how long I've been here. When I started my library career, paranormal, urban fantasy was just kind of starting to really pop off and it was just very, very, becoming very mainstream, very, very popular authors. And it's kind of back. I mean, the authors that were popular then are sort of starting to get in and start writing now. And then there are authors who are absolutely engaging with that kind of, those themes and sort of twisting them and playing with them. And I love that. So this title just runs right smack dab into this re-engagement in urban fantasy that is happening right now. What if a few chosen ones had retired, banded together, opened a magic store in a living house in Salem, Massachusetts? Think sort of a retired Buffy, retired Harry Dresden.
Really cranky retired Harry Dresden.
Really cranky retired Harry Dresden and Anita Blake. Mm-hmm. But needless to say, they're going to need to come out of retirement and save the world because they are those people. They are going to do those things. This is fun, very funny. It plays really well with the notion that it's hell getting old. and it, I think it's just so timely. You've got a Buffy reboot in the planning. You've got urban fantasy just back pretty strong right now. And rebooting, too. It's sort of rethinking itself as well. And I would just highly recommend it. It's coming out later this month, and it's called Slayers of Old. Jim C. Hines. And I just think everybody should run and read it.
Just the snippet he read at the signing.
Mm-hmm.
I had trouble staying in my seat. I was laughing so hard.
Mm-hmm.
Just the intro. Just open it up, read the intro.
Yes.
You'll be ready for it.
Yep, absolutely. It is, yes. I'm sorry. I just really, really loved it. And so I just want everybody to know about it. And I'm just trying to tell everybody when I can.
I have to say, when Jessica told me about it, I was like, Christine's going to love that. So we definitely get to know like what our colleagues and friends in the library community love in it. Yeah, mm-hmm. Instantly, I was like, oh, Christine's going to be so happy. So,
I mean, you're talking about a time where we also have, there's a bit of an 80s thing, too, going on
yes.
here in the sense that, the Golden Girls have a mystery series that has started.
Yes.
There is a
right.
first book in a Golden Girls yes. mystery series. There are...
Yeah. Well, they're rebooting Murder, She Wrote right
yep.
now.
Yes, yes.
So,
yep. I mean, it's the 80s, 90s, early aughts, kind of all right now. Because I was actually, mm-hmm. I can think of another book that I'm not going to be able to come up with the title of, but Ace Atkins has a book that sounds very much like 80s spy movies. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's, but with humor.
Ooh, I've heard that.
So I'm kind of intrigued by that as well. So there's just a lot of that nostalgia is running rampant, and I think this book has the humor and if you ever wanted to know what happened to the Scooby Crew. Yeah, this is a good
Scooby
one.
Crew.
Oh yeah.
Christine, do you want to go next with your
sure.
direction before
yep.
I go?
Another author I really like to read is T.J. Clune. And
see, this is why I like Christine.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about House in the Cerulean Sea and its follow-up, Somewhere Across the Sea. I'm having a problem remembering it today when every time I see the cover, the song, Somewhere Beyond the Sea, goes flying through my
head.
Yeah, it's the name. Well, they use it right in there, too, so...
It's podcast effect.
Yes, it is.
Yes. But I totally adore these books. They're what I call my lovely books. I actually made a list out on the website of my lovely books. The books that you read and you slow down and you wallow in the language and you fall in love with the characters and you get very, very emotionally invested and the place is almost a character, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the premise of these books because it's the idea of what if there were people being born with powers? How would they be treated? How would they be raised? And you're following a main character who's been working for the ministry that handles the unusual children. And he is sent frequently to different orphanages or schools for these types of children to make sure that they're being run right. Well, he gets sent to a very peculiar one because there are a lot of very oddly and highly powered children at this one. and they want to be sure it's okay. So he really didn't have to spend a lot of time at these places in comparison to the house in the Cerulean Sea, where he goes and meets a very unusual but very amusing group of children and their caretaker. And they're funny, they're witty, but he also has this way of getting inside a situation so that you feel what these people are going through. So you get an understanding of one of the children, and I'm not ruining anything because he shows up so quickly. His name's Lucy, short for Lucifer, son of Satan. And he is delightfully charming, and he's seven. So what do you do with a seven-year-old with that level of power? And he's, you know, periodically going, should I just get rid of all of this? Or, you know, I'm going to turn you all into toads. And the caretaker for the orphanage is like, Lucy, we know you're not really going to do that. And you can see in it, you know, Lucy making these comments and having temper tantrums like a seven-year-old does, yet also kind of scared of the outside world because he worries what people are going to say to him or if he might accidentally hurt somebody. And he's afraid that people won't like him because of who he is. Mm. And you really get to feel for all the characters have their trauma, their different issues, their different abilities, and how they are not seen well by the outside world and how they kind of come to integrate back into their local community throughout this. And it's just so lovely, even when he's discussing the trauma, because you can feel for these people, you really get inside their heads and you can see how that parallels things that go on in real life. Mm-hmm. And I think it's brings a level of empathy that a lot of authors struggle to, and he does it with seemingly such ease.
I agree.
Yeah.
The other book I wanted to talk to is, we're kind of going to go to the sillier end of, silly meets dark end of things. There's an author, Derek Landy, and he has written a series called Skullduggery Pleasant. And the basic premise is Stephanie Edgley, her uncle has passed away, and he has left her the vast majority of his estate. He was a writer of these magical horror novels. Well, one night while she gets stranded at her brand new house by a terrible rainstorm that washes out a bridge, somebody comes knocking saying, give me the key. And she's like, what key? I have no idea what you're talking about. He breaks down the door, and behind him comes barreling in this guy she saw at the reading of the will. He's wearing this, looking at sort of like Tom Baker from Doctor Who, with the big fuzzy wig and sunglasses and a big scarf wrapped around his head and a hat. And it all flies off while he's fighting this guy that was trying to find this key. And when it all comes off, you realize he's a walking, talking, fireball-throwing skeleton. And that's how she gets introduced to the fact that there's this whole world of magic next to ours. So it sort of it's good for the people that like that kind of vibe. But there's a little more of a horror element to it, just because it's a dark magical world. There's not a lot of happy joy. They've had a lot of wars. They've been around a long time. Some of this is aftermath and people that have issues with each other after the last war. But I also like, as you progress through the series, you get to watch Stephanie grow up. She starts out about 12, and in the current book, which I think is 15, she's in her 20s now. And you get to see her explore herself. She has a boyfriend towards the beginning. She has a girlfriend in the later books. You get to see how all of this horrific stuff that's happened that she's been a part of affects her trauma, an addiction, not like a chemical addiction, but addiction to a magical calming device later on, and how she has to deal with it when that gets broken and she has to deal with the coming off that addiction and learn to deal with her trauma in a healthy mm-hmm. way so she can function. And you get to see the trauma the other people have and how some people are coping well and some people are not, and how they help each other and the friends she builds along the way. And the characters really grow really well. And it has a darkly sarcastic sense of humor that only the Irish seem to have. After the whole combat in the building, Skullduggery comes up to her and goes, you look like you're going to faint. Are you going to faint? I think so. Well, then why don't we move you to the... Oh, wait. She faints into his arms. So they have this great witty repartee between a lot of the different characters. Mm-hmm. It's a delightful series. A little dark, but it's... I think they address a lot of really good things in it. He's an excellent author.
And that's Jay, right? That's a...
It's a Jay series.
It's a children's chapter book.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Cool.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm going to move in a little different direction, but I'd say that the trauma piece in both of the books that you just talked about rings true with this one. The book that I'm going to talk about is called Mother Mary Comes to Me, and now you will all have that song in your head, by Arundhati Roy. And Arundhati Roy is best known for her Booker Prize-winning novel, The God of Small Things, from 1997, and The Ministry of Utmost Happiness following that, which won a lot of literary awards as well. But this book is utterly, utterly unique. It came out in September, and it kind of blew me away. I have to say I really loved it. And at its heart, it's memoir. And it's a memoir that's the story, Arundhati's story, about her extremely formidable mother, Mary Roy, who was an extremely difficult mother. I mean, on the end of, like, the mommy dearest end of, and she talks about that a little bit, but in that extreme end of difficult mother, verbally and physically abusive, inattentive, pushed both she and her brother away. In a way, I've looked at a lot of interviews after this book, Arundhati sort of had the mother role in the relationship for their whole life because she was the one who kept the relationship going. She was the one, as the daughter, who kept going back to keep the relationship there. And interestingly, though, this is not a book about my mother ruined my life. It's more like, I love this woman so fiercely. And when she dies, she's so deeply affected by her death, and her brother's like, you know, she wasn't that good to us. And she's like, I know, but it's who she made me is who I am. And now without her, I don't quite understand. And so it's sort of how her mother's presence in her life formed her in the way that a diamond is formed in a way. And it's also then about Arundhati Roy's political development as a political animal in the world, basically. Somebody who has been accused of contempt by court by the Indian government multiple times, was put in prison briefly, based off of her words. Freedom of speech has been interpreted very interestingly in India, and this book talks a lot about different political incidents, environmental movements, and Arundhati's participation in that. It talks about how when she wrote The God of Small Things, it was this massive international bestseller, and how her finances quickly changed, and how that's always been uncomfortable for her, and some of the things she did with her money. But it's also the story of Mary Roy, and she's always trying to figure out, who is my mother? Who was she? Her mother started a school. I'm actually going to look at my notes because I can't remember the name of it. It's called the Palikodam School in Katyam in 1967. So this mother, her mother started a school, which was a huge thing for a woman to do, and tried to provide a really egalitarian education in a community that was very conservative, that was not supportive of that. And so her mother had this dogged determination, was the hero of so many people in their lives, a mentor to all these people. So on the one hand, she was this wonderful, strong woman. She fought inheritance laws in India and won. But on the other hand, she was one of the most difficult mothers ever. You know, so it was sort of this contradiction. She respects her mother, but she has a hard time reconciling who she was. So I highly encourage readers to pick this one up. If you're interested in anything political, in political history, in reading about somebody who cannot turn away from injustice, who lives and breathes the fight against injustice. I think that was part that was really touching. Yes, it's about her mother, but it's also about her and about how that is who she is. And perhaps the domestic sphere is not her most comfortable place either. It's more the sphere of fighting injustice. So I just was wonderful. It was a wonderful book. There's a quick quote I will read. It's on the back of the book, but it's so good. Perhaps even more than a daughter mourning the passing of her mother, I mourn her as a writer who has lost her most enthralling subject. In these pages, my mother, my gangster, shall live. She was my shelter and my storm. And I have to say, the gangster part, she describes also that literally means she wore these high top tennis shoes, her mother, at the end of her life. She's like this 80-year-old woman wearing these like high tops for stability. I mean, she just sounds like charming and like fascinating. So I highly recommend you pick up this one.
Yeah. All right. I have another memoir. I have The Quiet Ear by Raymond Antrobus. This is a memoir from an award-winning poet. It really examines his growing up deaf and racially mixed. So his father was a Black Jamaican living in England. His mother was an English, white English woman. It leaves him in a space where he doesn't fit either side particularly well. Then on top of that, he's legally deaf. He cannot hear a lot of high frequencies, but he's not totally deaf, so people don't believe that he's deaf. So as he's growing up, he's really, you know, teachers don't know what to do with him. They think he's more of a problem child than actually dealing with the fact that he's deaf. Eventually, they pull him in and put him into a school for deaf children, but he is always he's not completely deaf. He doesn't know sign language. He does learn BSL along the way, but it is a kind of a very interesting story because it is not, you know, it's not a monolith. There is gradations of hard of hearing and deafness while still all being legally deaf. And there are people who are born deaf. There are people who are, you know, it's really interesting because they don't figure it out until he's maybe six. His father kind of doesn't take it. His father's sort of afraid of that outcome, so doesn't take it as well or as seriously in some ways. He really kind of throws himself into the hearing world as much as he possibly can. So, like, refuses to wear his hearing aids places at times because he just doesn't want to stand out any more than he already does. And it, you know, all of that just sort of changes. It's a different, it's a different view of growing up deaf than having somebody who's grown up in a household of deaf people. And that it's not the traditional deaf culture that I'm aware of. It is almost more fighting against that. This is a really, it's heartbreaking, it's really moving, but he also, along the way, he's sharing interesting stories about influential deaf figures that he would have liked to have known about growing up. He just didn't have that kind of representation, so he really tried so very hard to fit into the hearing world. And this is just, it's beautifully written. You cannot miss the fact that he is a poet. And it sort of goes to how he has learned and presented himself and developed himself. He reads the audiobook. He is a spoken word poet as much as a writing. And he has gone to like speech therapists over the years and to minimize misunderstanding of his voice. I would say you probably can tell that he is deaf in some level, but it's a mix of that and a strong British accent. It's beautifully read, but it sort of then makes you step back and think, but he did it because he needed to fit in. Right. So it's really interesting. It really makes you think. Again, this is The Quiet Ear by Raymond Antrobus.
What was the poetry collection that we both really loved? We'll have to put it in the show notes by him.
I don't know, but I
can't remember the name. We'll put it in
nope,
there.
Nope, I'm going to blank.
But one actually. Of the poems I remember was about how his father had grown up and culturally was really afraid about what would happen to his son
exactly.
if he was deaf. And it was something like yeah. he almost like kind of boxed his ears or something like
the,
that.
His
something
only relationship with the idea of being deafness was somebody who was made deaf
yes,
in an act of violence when
was.
He was a child.
Okay, and so he was just so...
So he just... It wasn't...
He was like, you're probably not deaf.
And the person disappeared.
Yeah. Yes, that
so,
was
I
it.
So, I mean, it was just sort yeah. of like, I'm not going to come up with it. I do want to say, because I kind of flipped it over thinking maybe it was going to be on the back of the book, but I just, even if I didn't know that I was already going to pick this up, the people doing the quotes on the back of this are Hani Fedarikib, Clint Smith, Alex Wong, Ilya Kaminsky, Javier Zamora. So, I mean, it's just, yeah. it's, and they're all just beautiful quotes about the book. So yeah. It's just, it's one of those things where I found it really moving and really interesting.
Sounds excellent. That's on my list this year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, this is Maddie, and I have the next book. It's actually a picture book. It's called The Interpreter by Olivia Abdahi. And the pictures are by Monica Arnaldo. So it is a really neat book. The Interpreter is about Cecilia, who is a kid. She loves soccer. She loves playing. But one of her major jobs in life is to translate for her parents, Spanish speakers, who are, you know, constantly looking to her to have, you know, her communicate their words to the DMV or the doctor's office or an accountant or any place where, you know, official sort of places. And then she has to then translate what is told to her back to her parents. And she is, you see that this is something her parents really rely upon her to do. And while she's happy to serve, I think that, you know, I think the book, the illustrations and how the story progresses, you really learn how stressful that can be for her, because she's like being taken away from, you know, fun things that she wants to do as a kid. And you also learn that, you know, she has an older brother who had this role before he goes off to college, but now it's her turn. And I guess I, you know, I empathize with the parents because, you know, my mother speaks English, but occasionally has trouble understanding others speaking English. So, you know, she immediately looks to me when I'm with her for me to translate. And I just am thinking of both the parents, like how helpless they must feel, but also just how much of a relief it is to them that they have this child who is helping them along. I think it's a lot of responsibility for a child. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, I wish they didn't have to go through that, but I also appreciate how much value they bring to their family and what a wonderful opportunity it is for them to be the voice for their parents who don't speak English. I really like Monica Arnaldo. I don't know if you are familiar with some of her work. I think she wrote something maybe a year or two ago called Mr. S. And she also is, I can't remember the exact title, something about a cheeseburger, just really quirky kinds of books, really fun.
You did Mr. S. on
Mr. S.
Yes, Mr. S.
That was so hard. Podcast. That was hard to figure out.
I know, it was, but it was funny. It was really, really neat. So, I would really like to recommend The Interpreter by Olivia Abdahi.
Right. That sounds really good.
Okay, so we have a couple of picture books. You've got picture books, I've got a graphic novel. I just want to quickly kind of talk about this one, because you have to see it to really kind of jump into it. But my recent reacquaintance with birds and nature, I've also noticed how birds are on a lot of covers, and sometimes they just grab me. But this book caught my eye, called Ew. It's Beautiful, by Joshua Barkham. It is a collection from the webcomic False Knees. I'm sorry, the birds are beautiful.
I love False Knees.
Yes. So I hadn't heard of it. So this is the first time I caught the cover of You, It's Beautiful, is this pair of blackbirds just staring as if they're staring. Yes. Yep.
Great.
As if they're staring into a camera, like looking down. And it goes with a comic that is basically a set of blackbirds have stolen a phone. And they're all looking down into this phone.
Oh, dear.
And then, and it, you know, they're like, hey, that guy who didn't want to let go of it. And but they're all kind of gathered around. And then eventually it buzzes and they're like, we did that. And so it goes on to the next thing. But it's just, so False Knees is another, the first False Knees collection is called False Knees. I totally had missed that. So I'm going back and reading that now. And aside from being, it's just beautifully drawn, it's witty, it's contemplative imaginings of the inner lives of birds and some other creatures too, but a lot of birds. And I think this would solidly appeal to Calvin and Hobbes fans as well. It's just, the moments of introspection and also just wittiness of Calvin and Hobbes. I think it would be really, if slow down, try that one. I think it's good.
Okay. I really want to check that one out.
Mm-hmm. Same here.
So I have a couple more picture books. The first one I want to recommend is Island Storm by Brian Floca, illustrated by Sydney Smith, one of my most favorite illustrators ever. It is storm time, hurricane time, tornado time, it seems, all year round, unfortunately. But especially lately, as I've seen things in the news in various parts of the country, this is a beautiful book about two children who are a little bit, let's live on the edge, sister, little brother, big brother. There's a storm coming. And these two siblings decide to go out and check things out before the big storm arrives. And I just want to read the opening lines. I mean, it's very poetic in so many ways, but the illustrations just super rock, super stand out. Now take my hand and we'll go see the sea before the storm. So each spread is like these children who are like just running down the path, running to the neighborhood. The city, the homes that are being boarded up, just being really like enthralled with everything they're feeling, the wind, the gravel that's coming up in their face. Just really, really neat. And just the words, you know, smashing and exploding. We stand there just to feel it all, wind, stone, wave, water, just these kids running around. And at one point, you know, they run into one of their neighbors who's out, you know, taking the dog for one last walk. And the neighbor's like, you know, you might want to get on home now, you know, because things are starting to swirl really, really crazy. But yeah, that middle spread with the neighbor and the dog, it's just gorgeous. I wish I could show it because
it's beautiful.
It is just gorgeous. But I really enjoyed just flipping through this two or three times because, again, the words and then just the curiosity of the children. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if I were a parent that I would want my kids running around out there like that, but they have such eagerness and such interest in, like, wow, something really exciting and maybe terrifying is about to happen, but we want to check it out. So the other book I have is actually related, Thunderland, and this is written and illustrated by Maggie Atkins-Willis. It's about a dad and a child, you know, and there's a little dog in the picture too, who kind of get a little afraid by the cracking and the booming of thunder and really hard rain, darkness. And the father kind of challenges the child, hey, you know, we might miss our chance. And the kid is like, what do you mean our chance? He's like, to go to Thunderland. And Thunderland is this place that the father creates inside the home with a blanket and a flashlight and just really wanting to create this fun experience. Like every time you hear the thunder, you know, and what happens. I'm going to give a short little shout out to Robert Chartrand out at the Hazlitt branch, because I have to say the dad kind of looks like him. I think his child is much older now, but still, I just thought, I love this book. Crack, boom, rumble, crack, okay, I say. Even though this doesn't feel like time for games, I'll try. And it's just, it's very much like a parent really engaging with their child to help alleviate fear, but also making something really fun and into a really nice memory. So I know storms really do bother dogs and maybe children out there. So I just thought this was a great book. Really liked it a lot.
Cool.
I love that idea of taking something really scary. It reminds me of Thunder Cake by Patricia Polacco, the grandma was like, let's make this Thunder Cake. I always love that book.
Uh-huh.
You know, make this cake and make this the new memory. I have to say, I kind of use that same concept with horses. Whenever when horses cry to each other, they really freak each other out and get each other worked up. So every time a horse would cry to my horse, I would pat her kind of really firmly and be like, good girl, to try to replace that thought, like, mom's going to praise me when they call. And it would kind of interrupt that thought in her head. So it's sort of like using that sort of replacement to try to think, like, I acknowledge that you're scared because that's important, but let's replace it with something more positive. Mm-hmm. So... All right, so I'm moving on to the next book. It is Hispanic Heritage Month, so I do encourage our listeners to check out just a bit longer, not much longer. We have a list up on the catalog for Hispanic Heritage Month titles. This book was one of those books, I don't know if you have a book, that you've seen almost your whole adult life, or actually, even when I was younger, my young adult life. Yeah. So the cover that I showed, now our listeners cannot see this, but I'm going to hold up a Leo and Diane Dillon cover of...
the one if I think of this book, that is exactly what I think of.
The House of the Spirits by Isabel Allende. This book was everywhere, and it came out when I was 7 in 1982, and so it was everywhere. And when I became a librarian, I'm like, that's an important book. I've never read it. I don't know what it's about, but you just kind of see it at Walden Books, B. Dalton, you know, all those places from the 80s you'd go to. So I thought, someday I'm going to read that book. Well, I read Eva Luna first, and that was a really rollicking, wild, fun right, Monty?
Yes, it
Monty
was.
Monty and I have talked about that. Okay. But I wanted to go back and read The House of the Spirits, and I was sort of inspired by August Women in Translation Month. I'm really fascinated by translated literature. This was a translated piece in 1982 when it came out, and this... this story, wow, it's really a masterpiece. It took me a long time to read. It's a thick one. But it is the story from about the 1910s through the 1970s of the Del Valle, or also Trueba, family. And it was also inspired, it's I wouldn't call it autofiction. It's not memoir. It's, of course, it's fiction. But it is very loosely inspired on Isabel Allende's real life. And when her grandfather, who is sort of the inspiration for Trueba, Esteban Trueba in the book, she wrote her grandfather a letter when he was turning 100, and that letter turned into this book. So Isabel Allende in real life was the niece of Salvador Allende, who was the president who was overthrown and murdered, assassinated in Chile. This book is not set in Chile, in quotes, if you could see my air quotes, but it's obviously loosely based on Chile. The poet in the book is Pablo Neruda, and he's a big part of the story, and the Allende family, including Isabel, did know him. And so this is a huge work of, you know, a family saga piece, and it's extremely harrowing, it's very powerful, it's very moving, it's filled with extremely strong women down this line, who are based on some characters from Isabel Allende's true family. It's filled with some horrifying, villainous people, in particular some villainous men, some who transform, some who do not. And it's just a work of kind of a masterpiece of historical, or political fiction, I would call it. But it really tells the story of class dynamics, of power, of... revolution, of fascism, of how when things start to disintegrate and get destroyed in a society, people continue to think it's not going to happen here on this street. It's not going to happen to my class, or, you know, that was actually in the book. It's not going to happen here. There's a book called that. But anyway, it's chilling and it's beautifully done. It can be a very difficult read, but I'm so glad I read it, and just an incredible, incredible work of fiction.
Okay. So this is Maddie again, and I do have one last book. This is a J fiction book. It's called Another by Paul Tremblay. I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. You might know Paul Tremblay for adult horror that he's done. This is his first middle grade horror book. And I have to say I picked it up because I thought it might sort of be like a slightly deeper version of like an R.L. Stine with blood and gore and that sort of thing. It is not. It is quite, quite chilling. This is about a boy. His name is Casey. He's 12. And like one day out of the blue, like he just gets, this is not right before, like during a school break of some kind, you know, there's a phone call and the mother's like, well, okay, sure, he can come over. He's listening, and a friend is coming over. And Casey's like, well, who is it? And I was like, you know what? I don't know. I didn't ask who's coming over.
That's not a good thing.
I know. So this character comes out of a burlap sack. And this is a friend. His name is Morel, as in the mushroom. And he is like, not even a real person, at least not in the beginning. He kind of reminds me, I'm picturing like a gingerbread man, you know, something. Like, and he's got like these deep hollow eyes, very much clay-like skin. And Casey's like, okay. And then he finds out that Morel is going to be staying for several days. Oh, and no. I'm like, wow, that's got to be stressful. Someone you haven't met before who's coming over for a long stay of a play date. But what I think is really fascinating about this book is like all these extra details, like in the background. I mean, this is post-COVID, and I am reading, I'm sure as all of you are, more and more books where that's being incorporated into the stories. Like, what happened during COVID? Casey has developed some sort of a stress-induced tic syndrome of some kind. So he has been, I don't know, seeing a therapist or seeing like a neurologist to help him with this condition and help him with his schools. He's had this huge incident that keeps coming up involving a Zoom call that is like really traumatic for him. When you just kind of like, oh, kids, why? Let's be kind to each other, loving to each other. But there are just so many issues in this book where, you know, he's referring to what happens when you're told over and over, trust your gut, but your gut is actually always afraid, and you're feeling like, you know, you keep stuffing fear down. I really liked the telephone aspect. This is like an old-fashioned telephone. I mean, I'm Gen X. I definitely remember the thing on the wall and like dialing the thing and the noises and the special rings. And it kind of, there are references to the telephone being like halfway on its way out. Like it's like instead of like, bring, it's kind of like, bring, like kind of the ring is like definitely kind of sad and running out of steam. Lots of drawing themes, lots of Naruto and just things that a lot of middle school, you know, Legend of Zelda video games that kids would really relate to. What is the horror part of this? Well, it's that this clay friend who at one point, like, you know, digs into his heart, into his skin, and flaps it over and puts in a drawing of a heart inside. I mean, just really strange sorts of things. This clay person is becoming, kind of taking over Casey's life and actually becoming Casey, if you will, maybe. Whoa. And Casey's starting to like, wait a minute, I've got to fight for myself, for my identity. The parents start referring to Morel as, you know, their son, or actually Morel refers to the parents as his parents. It's really kind of like, I don't know. It was
very fae.
A psychological-ish, I suppose.
Yeah, it's really smart. Interesting. You know, that's interesting take on the changeling idea.
Yeah,
it is.
Yes, and exactly. Thing, yeah. That's what definitely double.
And I feel like, so I read probably his most famous adult novel was Cabin at the End of the World, which was made into a horror movie as well. And it is, he is very good at just sort of building up psychological horror.
It's very slow burn. Very slow burn. Like, I was probably maybe 20% into it when it started to get like, ooh, wait a minute, what's going on here? And I think fifth graders and above would really, really sink their teeth into this one. As you know, especially if you're thinking about issues related to bullying, related to, you know, just perceiving how others think of you, like mm-hmm. having your parents pity you or a teacher pity you, that's got to be really hard. And you think maybe that your parents or your teachers don't know that you know, but I know when someone's pitying me. So I think of this child in the story, and it's really, really interesting. So I hope some of you will get a hold of it. Another by Paul Tremblay.
Okay. That's really intriguing.
Yeah.
I don't, it's not my genre, but as a kid, I would have loved
Yeah, no
that,
blood, but, no gore, but yeah, lots yeah. of psychological.
I love yeah, really fairy tales,
yeah.
so
yeah,
that would that, fall that right very, into that.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. very definitely. Okay, so I think that's all we have today. Thank you all. This has yeah. been fun.
And yes, yeah. thank you for having me.
Yeah, happy good
thank you for being here.
Happy October.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. Happy reading.